Roots has partnered with Mark Arnold to develop a visual timetable that is church-specific, including things like worship, baptism, communion, and prayer. Visual timetables can be very helpful resources for children and adults with additional needs to help them understand the often changing activities happening in church and be prepared for what's coming next. Find out more about these visual timetables and order one for your church at rootsforchurches.com/VT, as in V for visual and T for timetable. Thanks for listening. Hello, Mark.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a delight. We would love to chat to you more about autism, additional needs, and how churches can support children, young people, and adults who have additional needs and autism in their churches. Can you tell us a bit more about how much autism there is out there? It feels like everybody's talking about it.
Yeah, and I think it's good that everybody's talking about it. And it's great to just have that awareness increasing out there. I think when I first started talking about additional needs broadly and autism as a part of that, probably 10 years ago now, we were commonly talking about how 1 in 100 children and young people, particularly, that's the area that I'm focused on, are autistic. And that figure still sometimes gets used today, but we've actually seen generally the statistics change over that 10-year period. And even quite recently, the Department for Health in Northern Ireland was doing some studies across schools in Northern Ireland, and their figures came out around about 1 in 23 children and young people in their study who are autistic. So a big, big change from 10 years ago, which raises some obvious questions around, you know, is there a fourfold increase in the number of autistic children and young people, or is there a different, perhaps better explanation for that? And there is a better explanation for it. It's better awareness, better understanding, better diagnosis, all kinds of factors that build into that. You know, it's not that long ago that the common perception in society was that autism is a boy thing, a male thing. We, of course, know that girls are autistic too, and understanding that better clearly has increased the number of children and young people who are diagnosed as autistic. So there's a big shift in numbers, not necessarily a big shift in the actual number of autistic people out there in our communities.
And can we talk about terminology? It feels like it maybe is a moving feast. Is it people with autism? Is it autistic people? Where is that sense of identity? Is the identity in autism is a primary way of defining me, or is it vary from person to person?
Yeah, so I think we have to look at it in two ways. We look at it in the context of the autistic community themselves. So people who are autistic, whether they're children, young people, or adults. And generally, they refer to that community as autistic people. So the identity is very much as an autistic person, and the autism is a key part of who they are. Now, individually, people can identify however they like, and we respect that. So if somebody individually prefers, as some do, to be referred to as a person with autism or a person who has autism, then that's fine on an individual level. But collectively, we tend to talk about autistic people. There's a great meme out there, which is two people. One of them has this sort of coloured shape inside of their head, and that's representing an autistic person. The autism is an integral part of who they are. The second person is holding a bag, and the sort of representation of autism is in the bag, and they're a person with autism. They're sort of carrying it in a bag as an accessory. And the point of the meme is that actually for the vast majority of autistic people, it's a key part of who they are, and therefore autistic person works better as a description for them.
And it's clear that no two experiences of autism are alike, and that it's a blanket term to describe some experiences that people are having, or some challenges, in fact. But how do people know if somebody has autism? Is it, do you have to wait for them to tell you? What's a good way for people to engage with this?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's never our job to diagnose somebody with whatever it is, unless we're part of a process that's actually actively doing that. Some people may, and typically, again, I'm thinking about this from children and young people, but some may be on a pathway to getting a diagnosis. Some may have a diagnosis, but they and their family may be reluctant to talk about that. Some may have a diagnosis and be willing to share everything about it. And we have to sort of respect that and understand those differences. You know, for families that might be reluctant to talk about it, it could be just because they're struggling with it all themselves. It's all new. They're trying to understand it all. It's difficult to articulate something when it's just completely new to them and they're trying to get their heads around it themselves. Or they may have had some bad experiences of talking about it, and then that's negatively impacted on them and their family. And so there can be all sorts of reasons. So we sort of have to go at their pace, go at the pace of the individual and their family, what they're willing to share with us, but also to try and create that sense of trust and relationship that encourages that communication. And that communication could either be from a family saying, hey, you know, we're investigating this, we're on a pathway at the moment, and we're finding that hard, perhaps, and would really appreciate some help. Or they've got a diagnosis and they're trying to understand that and get their heads around it. But actually, yeah, being able to talk about that with people that get it and understand it and helpful, then that can be a really positive step forward as well. So going at their pace is a really important thing to do. Now, that doesn't stop us from, in the case of a child or young person that needs some extra support, and that support, you know, we can start to figure out even without a diagnosis. So, you know, there might be some things. We might see that a child struggles with communication, or they find loud noise really difficult, or whatever it might be. We don't have to wait until there's a diagnosis to try and help them and support them. But we can be more focused with that when we have got something more as a diagnosis to work from.
Yeah, and as a church, we're not quite in the same situation as, say, the NHS or a school, where funding particularly is tied to a diagnosis or anything like that. Yeah. We can be supportive.
Absolutely.
Along the journey. And so it is that sort of stepping into the gap as much as we're invited.
Yeah, it's seeking to support and help where we can see that there is a need for that. A diagnosis is helpful because that gives us more focus to what we can do. Information from families about what's working at home or at school can be really helpful there as well. But even in the absence of all of those things, we can still see a child or young person that needs some help, needs us to do things differently, needs us to be more aware of their sensory needs, for example, and for us to adapt and put things in place to support them. I think that's a really important point as well. It's always our role and responsibility to do the adapting. We should never expect a child or young person to fit in or do the adapting themselves. It's up to us to work with children, young people, their families, to figure out what we need to do and what we need to change to make church a better place for everybody.
Fantastic. Now, I'd like to backtrack a little bit and find out a bit more about you personally. What's your journey? Why this interest in autism and additional needs?
Yeah, so our journey, I think there's two parts to it, really. I've been a children's and youth worker forever. During that time, I've met lots and lots of children and young people with a wide range of different additional needs. And it's always been my passion to help them to be fully involved in all that we're doing, to be fully included, to belong in the groups and churches that they're a part of, to not be on the margins and excluded, but really to be an integral part of everything. But then 19 years ago, our youngest child, James, was diagnosed as autistic and with learning difficulties. Along the way, he's picked up other diagnoses of epilepsy and anxiety, and there are other things going on for James as well. So our journey as family and as church and in the work that I do at Urban Saints have been very much influenced by our journey with James and helping him to be fully included and involved in everything that we do, for his voice to be heard, for him to be able to, be seen and accepted for who he is. And so at Urban Saints, a few years ago, we had an opportunity in the staff team to start a project that was related to children's and youth work. That's what we do. But maybe something we didn't do so much of, or a new area of that. And I picked this area of additional needs. It took off. And so, for 10 years, I've been involved in this area and full time for the last 6 years, just getting out there and, helping churches, groups, organizations to understand more about this really important demographic in our community. And to work together to make a difference for everyone.
Oh, that's fantastic. I think I first came across you attending some training for our church to help us learn how to better support children with additional needs. And I do think churches have been crying out for this kind of help. A lot of children's and youth work is done by volunteers.
Yeah.
We're not trained teachers usually. I mean, some people are. Even if you're a youth worker, historically, there's not a lot of training or preparation around anything to do with additional needs, disabilities, that kind of thing. You learn about the Bible and how to run fun youth groups or how to teach a good Bible story. But and we do stuff around safeguarding, but there really isn't a lot of content and training. So I think it's key for people to gen up on this, to learn how to support. And it feels, I think it can feel really intimidating for a Sunday school leader, a children's volunteer, because you don't know quite who's going to walk through your door. You
right.
don't know the extent of the need, and there's so much variety. There's so much possibility of, you know, this kid might have a visual impairment, this kid might be autistic, but not like the previous autistic child I've worked with. And so it is like a skill set or a tool belt of, these are some things that help. But I think there's also a mindset change, isn't there, of like, how can we best include, but also frame what we're doing in a way that these children and young people and adults in our church really feel like they belong, and that we are sort of reshaping ourselves in our community to bring out the best in them, that they can contribute and connect with us really well.
Absolutely. And I think that mindset, that heart, is probably the most important thing. And you know, there's lots of practical things that we can do, but actually it has to start with that mindset, that heart, that wanting to make a difference, to make sure that everyone's included, that everyone belongs in the church or group that that they're a part of. In the work that I do, I think I've sort of categorized churches into three groups. So there are churches out there that are doing an amazing job, a fantastic job of including children, young people, adults with a range of additional needs, disabilities, differences, have been doing this well for a while. There's a big group in the middle who would love to do more, have that heart and that passion to do more, but aren't sure how to do that, where to start, perhaps worried about getting it wrong, making it worse by doing the wrong thing or saying the wrong thing. And that's where I spend a lot of my time, is with that middle group, just helping them to get some tools to be able to put that heart into action. Sadly, there are still some churches who don't see this as for them. And there's horror stories I could tell you of how children, young people, families have been treated. And it's heartbreaking to hear those stories. But that is a demographic still. That church group is still there. And my heart breaks for them and for the families that journey with them. But I'm seeing more and more churches shifting towards the more positive ends of that line, though, and that's really encouraging. And yeah, there are more and more of us out there that are giving a voice to this and helping churches to make those changes and to get that culture shift that's part of that heart and mind that we've been talking about.
And it doesn't have to be a big church with somebody who's specifically trained in additional needs. You know, a little church can be just as good at this.
Absolutely. Yeah. It covers, you know, any church, you know, big mega churches down to a little tiny country parish church somewhere. If we've got that heart to reach out into our communities and say, hey, everyone's welcome here. Everyone's can be included. Everyone belongs. And to work with those children, young people, families, adults, if we're thinking about adults too, it's so important that we do inclusion with people and not unto them. So important that we ask them. You know, I love the teaching that Jesus gives us on this time and time again when he's encountering people with disabilities or health conditions or whatever it might be. He teaches us so much. When he met Bartimaeus, and Bartimaeus stood in front of him, a man who's blind, and Jesus says, what would you have me do for you? He asks him. He gives him the dignity and the respect of actually being able to articulate for himself what it was that he wanted. Now, you know, I'm as sure as I can be that Jesus knew Bartimaeus was blind. And as God made flesh, he knew what Bartimaeus wanted from him. But he didn't assume. He didn't just reach out, give Bartimaeus his sight and move on. He gave him the dignity and respect of being able to ask what it was that he wanted. And Bartimaeus said, I want to see. And then Jesus did give him his sight. But yeah, now asking that question is so important. And it's often a step that we overlook. We just think, oh, we've got to put all these things in place. What can we do? What can we do? And we forget to ask the audience, as it were. Mm-hmm. So important that we remember to do that too.
So can we have a little segue here? Because I know that I've been reading up on autism, and I've been reading Claire Williams' brilliant book, Peculiar Discipleship. And she talks really helpfully around different ways of understanding autism. Mm. And she talks about the medical model and the social model. So the medical model being around autism is a problem. It's not neurotypical and it needs a cure. And the social model of thinking of it, of that neurodiversity is part of the great diversity that God created and is in the world. And that actually our society makes it more difficult for somebody who's autistic to participate, to find the fullest way of living their life. And so actually it's us that needs to change, not the autistic person.
Yeah.
How do you understand this, and how have you found those models helpful?
I think those models are really helpful because, as you said, the medical model is all about cure and healing. It refers to autism as autism spectrum disorder or condition. You know, and a disorder or a condition is something that you try and cure and find a way of fixing. And that's actually, yeah, not the reality of what a lot of autistic people want. They are very happy with who they are, very happy being autistic. Don't see any need for that to be changed in any way. What they would love to see changed, though, is the way the society and the world in which we all live is set up. Because as you mentioned with the social model, it's very much set up for neurotypical people. And that creates barriers for neurodiverse people of all different kinds, which can in effect disable them. So it can be society and the world that's the disabling factor here. In a world that was more equal, that was fairer, that took everybody's needs into account, then it would be a better place for us all to live in. And so that social model works much better because it puts, as you said, the emphasis on change on us all, on the world, on society, rather than an individual needing to be healed, cured, fixed in some way, which just doesn't fit with who they are or how they feel.
And I think it'd be fair to say that as families, as individuals, autistic individuals would be on a journey between those models. They may be in one bit for a while and one model for another. And their theology about God and about healing and about all of that, we can't say this is what everybody who's autistic thinks. How did you sort of wrestle with those models as a parent?
Yeah, really good question. I think it evolves in time. I know when James was first diagnosed as a two-year-old, we knew nothing at all about autism. We knew nothing about any of this world that suddenly James and us as a family found ourselves in. And like most parents in that situation, you're looking for it to go away. Your instant gut reaction is, please let this go away. If you've got a faith, you might pray that and say, please, Lord, let's just wake up tomorrow and James won't have autism and everything can be back to what we were thinking it would be. But of course, that isn't the reality. And actually, in time, we got to go through understanding more about James, more about autism, become more accepting of who he is and those changes in our family. And so today, my prayer is much more about being able to understand James better, be able to understand his communication and help him more, to be able to understand the frustrations that he experiences as a neurodiverse person in a neurotypical world, and to try and break some of those barriers down with him to make it a better, fairer place for him and everyone else. So my prayers are very different now to what they were all those years ago. I totally get that parents would be praying those things, hoping those things. And sometimes on this journey, there's a parallel with what some folk listening to this might have come across as the five stages of grief. And we might all know families who we could say are in denial. They've had a diagnosis or they're on that journey and they're just hoping it's all going to go away, that somebody's just going to say, actually, we've made a mistake. There's nothing here at all. Forget that this was ever mentioned. They might be in anger, which is a terribly difficult place for families to be. Drives families apart. There was a recent study over in the US which suggested that married couples with an autistic child, as many as 84% of them end up splitting up. Catastrophic figures. And it does illustrate some of the pressures that families can be under. And then going on to bargaining, depression, and hopefully to acceptance, that point of actually, recognizing that this is the new reality. It can still be a good reality for our child and for us as a family, and to journey into this new land and explore it together. And that's a great place to be. Doesn't mean that when you get there, you stay there. You can be spiraled back into those earlier stages again, but you get better at getting back to acceptance again each time. But it's a journey that every family will go on when they get a diagnosis of any kind for their child. And so I totally get that in those early stages, that prayer might be, please let it just all go away. But that, in our case, changed and adapted to praying now much more about understanding and communication and support.
And it just strikes me that those families, those marriages, those individuals and children, young people, we really need so much support. And the church is in a place where we could step in. We could be shoulders to cry on. We could be encouragers. We could be helpers. And I think that community is so needed and it is hard. I think those families often feel isolated.
They do. They often feel isolated. They feel like it's just them in the world that has started on this journey, and there's a million questions and no idea where to go to for answers. Can be really isolating. So to have those different kinds of support, it could be connecting them with other families that perhaps are on that journey too. It could be, as you say, that shoulder to cry on, or just a friendly face to go along to some of those daunting meetings that they might have to go to. It could just be a couple of people who able to just go around and childmind for a few hours so that family can just go and invest in each other for a bit. It could be just going and doing some practical things just to help out, because, yeah, you know, sometimes those things can slip in the chaos of trying to cope with everything. So lots that churches can do to journey with families. And it's much more than, you know, an hour on a Sunday morning or a club night. It's actually understanding when those families are under pressure and being there for them standing with them, supporting them through those tough times too.
It sounds like we're looking for more people who have a heart for pastoral care more than we're looking for a children's or a youth volunteer.
Yeah, absolutely. So sometimes when I'm running a training session, and I'll talk about how it can be really helpful to have, you know, one-to-one support for a child in church, or folk that can come and get alongside families and so on. And initially, people might think of that, oh, we need to get some more people to join our children's team. And actually, as you've said, it's much more a pastoral care kind of role, whether it's sitting with a child or young person in their session and supporting them and helping them and recognizing if they're struggling and knowing what to do if that's the case, or whether it's getting alongside a family that's got a big meeting coming up and they're worried about it and perhaps would value some prayer, perhaps would value somebody coming as a friendly face to that meeting with them so that they've just got that bit of moral support, whatever it might be. That pastoral care kind of role is really key there. And yeah, lots of churches can offer that. Big churches, small churches, there's folk that are good at that. That's, you know, a sort of foundation of what we are as church, isn't it? Being pastoral. So that can really help families through those difficult periods in their journey.
So coming back to a church meeting or a youth group, a midweek event, What are some of the really simple things that a church might do, I suppose, for accessibility or to include people with autism, or should we say it the other way around, autistic people, in their activities, in their events? What can they do?
I think there's plenty of things that we can do, but the starting point is always ask the audience, is ask that child, young person, their family, what are some of the things that would be helpful for them? Drawing in on perhaps what they do at home or what's done at school, for example, that could be helpful in a church context as well. So learning from those other areas of a child or young person's life. You know, we always must do inclusion with people and not unto them. So asking the audience is always the starting point. But then starting to build up some ideas for practical things that we can do. It could be that a child or a young person gets sensory overwhelmed. So looking at ways that we can reduce sensory input might be something like providing ear defenders for if it's loud, or some dimming of the lights if it's too bright, that kind of thing. It could be looking at providing different ways for a child or young person to understand what's going on in the session, things like a visual timetable, so that they've got some visual prompts that let them know what's happening now, what's coming next, maybe when their favourite thing is coming. For James, that was always snack time, loved snack time. So it was always important for him to know when snack time was coming. So a visual timetable can help in that context. It could be recognising that, yeah, we sometimes have that need to fidget and fiddle with things. So providing some fidget fiddle toys that a child or young person can use. One thing that always is helpful is understanding what that child or young person enjoys doing. What's their favourite thing? Could be 101 things. You know, so sometimes we might use a one-page profile. For example, chefkids.co.uk provide a range of different one-page profiles that are downloadable for free. And that asks three key questions. What do people like and admire about me? That's a great place to start. Quite an affirming place to start as well, isn't it? Then what makes me happy? So, what do you enjoy doing? Let's use that to help them to learn. Could be Lego, could be Minecraft, could be drawing. It could be 101 things, but let's find out and use that to take them into the stories or the themes or the topic that we're looking at that week with something that's familiar to them that they enjoy using. And then the third thing it asks is how I want to be supported. And so, again, getting their voice heard there so that they or their family can share with us how best to support them is really helpful. So, I mean, there's lots more that we could add to that, but those are some of the perhaps more common things. But always starting with asking the audience, get the family and the child, young person to share what helps them and what we can do to make that a reality in church as well.
And those are wonderful ways to help a child feel welcome, feel like I can manage this. How do we move beyond just it being all right and I can survive this to I really feel like I'm part of this, I belong here, these people really get me?
Yeah. So often there's three stages to this. The first stage is accessibility. And that's what all churches have to do under the Equality Act to make what they do accessible for everybody. That's ramps and disabled loos and all that kind of thing. And then there's inclusion, which is actually providing the tools for everybody to be fully included in what's going on. So that could be some of the things we've talked about. It could be in other contexts. It could be having somebody doing British Sign Language interpretation, for example. Just make large print resources, those sorts of things, so that everybody that visits is able to fully participate in everything that's going on. But you're still a visitor. You're still a guest in that scenario. You're rocking up. Somebody's giving you the resources that you need to take part, and then away you go. But where we really want to get to is belonging. And belonging is where people are valued as part of the church family. They're missed for all the right reasons if they're not there. People, you know, check up and say, hey, you weren't in the group last week. We really missed you. Is everything okay? And they're able to fully engage with everything that's going on and serve each other, serve the rest of their church community, use the giftings and abilities that they've been given. So, for example, there's a young man that I know called Kieran, and Kieran is brilliant at tech. And his church, as he was growing up through the youth group, started to recognize that gifting that he had and started to get him to be involved in running the tech in church. And he's brilliant at it, does a great job. It gives him a key role. He feels valued and at home in church. He really belongs. And he uses that gift now to support Christian festivals and other events as well. So it's that true sense of belonging where actually this is your spiritual home. You're as valued as much as anybody else. You can serve just like everybody else does. That's where we really want to get to on this journey from accessibility through inclusion to belonging.
It's beautiful, isn't it, when you see the potential for challenge, but also the prospect of how much people can really feel connected, loved, enjoyed. And there are bumps on this journey, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Plenty of them. But can we be the kind of church communities that rejoice with people when they are succeeding and loving life, and that cry with them when it's hard? But I think there's a real richness to having walked that journey with people.
Yes.
And just getting some of those skills to be able to not flinch, not get anxious about it, but to step forward in real compassion. And I think, as you just keep saying, that the key is relationship and
it
conversation, talking to families, talking to individuals and saying, how can we help? What can we do? And maybe being honest that, like, I don't know how to do that yet, or we don't have those resources yet, but let me learn.
Yeah. Let's do this together.
Exactly. Yeah. And teach me, or let's try some things, and maybe that's not going to work, and that's okay. So if people come up with lots of good ideas, or what's the sort of, I know we were talking earlier about, like, you know, there are probably 15, 20 ideas that they could do. but that might not be helpful to try all of them.
Yeah. So in conversation with family, you know, with children, young people themselves, start thinking about all the things that could be changed that could make a difference. So what do we need to put in place? What do we need to change? What do we need to provide? You know, what are the practical things? You know, we've talked about a bunch of them already, but you could easily come up with a list of 15 or 20 things. But don't do all of those in one go. Because if on Sunday, suddenly there's 20 changes, 20, you know, in some cases, quite significant things that have happened, that in itself could be overwhelming for that child, young person that we're trying to support better. So have that conversation, build that list of however many ideas that might be, but then with the family, try and think about what are two or three to start with? What are the quick wins? What are the things that we can put in place that can happen quickly and start to make a difference? And then let's evaluate those. Let's see how they're going. Let's measure them to see if they're working. And then in time, we can add more of those ideas once those earlier ones have settled and that child or young person's got used to them. That means they're not going to get overwhelmed. And we can measure what's working and what's not and gradually build up the support that we're providing week by week.
Fantastic. So go slow, step by step, keep talking in relationship with people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sounds good.
That's it.
And we have developed a little resource in partnership with you.
We have, yes.
So Roots have worked with Mark to develop a visual timetable for churches. We mentioned visual timetables a little bit before. These are icons, sort of visual prompts that allow a person to see what's coming next.
Yeah, so it's always good to make what we do multisensory, to make them visual. The visual timetable and the cards that we've created have that aim of being able to visually represent each stage, perhaps of a church service or of a children's youth session, so that the people that are using them can see what's happening now, what's coming next, what's coming later, all the different stages of that. And that can take away so much of the anxiety and stress that can build up with not knowing those things. You know, just imagine going into a setting where you had no idea what's going on, what's expected of you, what's coming next, when the bit you're looking forward to might happen, when the session itself is going to end, and you know, will that end? And when will you be going home or whatever? And having something visual that represents that journey and gives you step by step those stages can really make a difference and help people with a wide range of different additional needs and differences and diversities to just feel much more at home, much more that they belong, as we were talking about just now.
Great. And so a lot of schools use these. Autistic people are familiar with using this, but historically this has just not been one that has church things like prayer and baptism, communion, those kind of things. So we've put together familiar elements of church-related activities and services, sessions, and they're basically on playing card-sized things, and they can be Velcroed or blue-tacked onto a board. Mm-hmm. And then as you go through the session, the young person can take them off to say that's finished, or they can look at them. Honestly, I find a visual timetable helpful for myself.
and that's the thing, actually. You know, we all like to know that information. And you know, so many of the things we've talked about, and particularly the visual timetable, is a great resource for everyone. Yeah, we can really all benefit from it. And actually, the beauty of using playing cards, and as you've described, is that you can make them suitable for each individual child or young person. So for some children and young people, it might be that, you know, what's happening now and what's happening next is enough to help them. Some might need to have, you know, what's happening now, next and later. Some might like to have the whole picture of the whole session. But using the cards, you can work with them to provide them with the information that they need, whether it's just a couple of them or whether it's the whole session laid out on cards. So it's a great way of doing it. And yeah, giving control to that child or young person to take the card off when it's finished, or you know, to put the next one on if that's how they use them. Again, as you've mentioned, these are used quite a bit in schools. And so making sure we're mirroring what's happening in the school setting, in our church setting, just gives that continuity for a child or young person, which can be hugely helpful for them as well.
Yeah, well, I'm really excited. And if you are interested in seeing more about this visual timetable, if you go to rootsforchurches.com/VT, V for visual and T for timetable, and then you can find out more, see what they look like, and order one for your church. I'm quite excited, and hopefully they'll be really useful to churches.
Yeah, I'm excited too. They look great, and yeah, really looking forward to seeing them in action out in churches.
Thank you. And thank you so much for your wisdom, for all you're doing in this, helping and supporting churches, and just giving us good language and good practice around this.
Oh, thank you. It's been great to chat, great to be involved, and yeah, looking forward to seeing how this rolls out.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You've been listening to the Roots for Churches podcast. You can find all our resources, articles, and more at rootsforchurches.com. See you again soon.